Welcome to The Apple Seed, the storytelling podcast from BYU Radio, where your family can gather for great stories from great storytellers in every episode. Stories bring us together, and we hope the stories on the show will spark memories and thoughts that you can share with the people you love. I'm your host, Sam Payne. And you know, there's this scene in Shakespeare's play Hamlet in which young Laertes is leaving home, and his dad, Polonius, is trying to get in a bunch of advice as his son is heading out. He says to his son, "Neither a borrower nor a lender be." Maybe you've heard that advice before. That's where it comes from. And Polonius also says this above all to thine own self, be true. Now, if you ask me to recite the things I learned from my dad, it might be tough for me to make you a list. I mean, it's not that he didn't teach me things. It just might be tricky to express those things as a list, you know? What I have are stories about things my dad and I did together, things that happened to us, things that happened to him. And telling those stories might be the best way to get at the things I learned from my dad. Well, other people have stories about their dads, too. And today, we're going to hear a couple. First, Bill Lepp talks about the father-son adventure of building a Pinewood Derby car together. Been there? Bill has. Here's the story, recorded live in the Appleseed studio.
When I was a little kid, probably like a lot of you men in here anyway, I was in the Cub Scouts. And every year in the Cub Scouts, we had a thing called the Pinewood Derby. And I'm going to guess that many of you have experienced this Pinewood Derby. And what happens is you get a block of pine wood that's maybe 7 inches long, probably 1 inch tall, and 2 inches wide. And the axles, or where the axles go, there's these two slits already cut underneath the car. It comes with 4 1-inch aluminum nails and 4 plastic tires. And the idea is that you, as a 7-year-old child, will go home with a knife and a saw and a hammer and some sandpaper, and you will make a 5-ounce car. And then you go with all your other little Cub Scout buddies, and there's a long track. You put your cars on top of the track. You basically let go of them, and then gravity pulls them down the hill, and you see who can win. They give you these cars, and the idea is that you, as the child, will make these cars, and that the adults can help and be ready to administer first aid. But that's all they're supposed to do. So I would get my block of wood, and I would stare at it, and I would think, I'm going to make an Indy car. I'm going to make a 1950s hot rod car. I'm going to make a wedge. All these ideas would go through my head, and I would sketch out these elaborate ideas, and I would have my car racing by all the other cars in these illustrations with black lines depicting speed as it just blew all the other Cub Scout cars away. And I would see inside that block of wood, I would see like Michelangelo, I could see the David of a car inside that block of wood. And I'd take it home and I would give it to my father, and he would look at it, and he would think about what car he was gonna make, a hot rod or an Indy car, and he would draw pictures of his car with little black lines depicting speed as it raced by all the other dad's cars. Now, to make it worse, I had 2 older brothers, so dad had already had 6 chances to win, and he hadn't won yet, so I was his last hope. I was the last kid that he was going to have that could make a Pinewood Derby car, and so he would take it, and Skeeter's dad would come over, so dad and Frank would be down in the workshop, and me and Skeeter would be sitting there while our dads carved our cars and sawed them and used sandpaper to sand them, and big, you know, a powerful electric sanders to make them as smooth as possible, and they would move where the wheels went so that the wheels were at the maximum place, and they would balance them so that all 4 wheels hit the ground at the same time. And sometimes they would let us help, because my mom would yell down, "John, the boys are supposed to be helping with the cars," and my dad would be like, "He is, he's sanding right now." And sometimes I was allowed to sand the bottom or the back. The one big thing that I was allowed to help with was the cars had to be 5 ounces. And so to make them 5 ounces, we would melt lead fishing weights. And I got to hold the propane gas torch Dad would cut the bottom of a like a soup can, and he would hold that with pliers, and we would plop the fishing weights into the can, and then I got to hold the propane torch like right here, and here's the lead, and I would watch it melt and boil, and I would breathe the fumes, and that explains things. And then Dad would have drilled holes in the bottom of the car, and we would pour the molten lead into those holes until the car was exactly 5 ounces and it was perfectly balanced, and it was the most beautiful thing in the world. And sometimes, again, I was allowed to touch it. And once I got to put a little tiny sticker on that said STP because I thought it was really cool. So Dad worked really hard on these cars. Frank worked really hard on these cars. And it was 10:30 the night before the race, and the phone rang. And my dad said, hello. And it was this kid called Christian in our Cub Scout pack. And Christian didn't have a really good family. And Dad said, well, why didn't you call earlier? Why didn't you call earlier in the week? And so we got in the car and we went to Christian's house, and we got Christian at about 11 o'clock at night. My dad and Frank Bart stood in the basement of my house, and they took a knife to Christian's block of wood, and they scraped it a couple of times, rounded the corners, sanded it, painted it, let Christian sand the back, and then they put the wheels right where the wheels go, and only three of them ever touched the ground at once. And you guessed it, that car won. It won everything. And you might think that the moral of this story is that if you wait till the last minute, you'll win. But that's not the moral of this story. In fact, it's not even moral time, because it's not the end of the story. So I grew up, and I had children, and my oldest child was in the Cub Scouts and came home with their block of wood. And I thought, I've always wanted to make one of these. And I said, I'll help you. And I went in the basement and I helped. I actually let my child do a whole lot more making their Pinewood Derby car than my father ever let me do. And I didn't let them melt the lead either. And so we took it, and we didn't win. We didn't win first place, but we did win second place. And I went home, and I called my dad, and I said, see, you should have let me help. You might have had a winner.
That was Bill Lepp with Pinewood Derby. And hearing Bill's story reminded me of a memory I shared with my dad when I was a kid, maybe 9 years old. In this memory, there's a guy who works with my dad who, we learn, owns a sailboat. And my dad arranges for himself and my little brother and me to go sailing with this guy one afternoon after work. And we do. I mean, sailing way outside our experience, impossibly exotic. After all, we lived in a desert. Dangerous, even, the thought of sailing was, though we weren't at all frightened. After all, my dad will be with us. An amazing adventure this will be, and we're almost beyond words. We're so excited. And the day comes. We climb into Dad's car, and we follow the skipper out to the lake. And here's the thing. The sky, all blue and clear when we set out for the lake, is now a low ceiling of gray clouds. No rain, just a slate-gray sky. And the skipper keeps looking up with a worried face. And he tells us that if there's rain, we better not be out on the lake. But, man, we're hoping and praying, because the thought of not getting to sail out on the lake is one we can't even bear. And after all, should there be any actual danger, we have our dad there. There's nothing from which he can't keep us safe, right? And there's no rain now, and not even much wind, so the skipper decides it's okay to set sail. And he straps us into life jackets, and soon we're scudding across the surface of the lake, and the dock is receding behind us, and it is everything. The bow cutting through the surface of the lake, the rising and falling of the boat, the sound of the wind and the sails, it is all we had hoped it would be. And we're out for about 10 minutes, when the fabric of my dad's windbreaker begins to whip against his shirt. And the skipper is looking at the sky again. And now there are raindrops, and the smooth surface of the lake is whipping into peaks all around us. And everyone in the boat knows the score. Our sailing afternoon has come to an end. The skipper turns the little craft around, and we head for the dock, now bobbing distantly ahead of us. And pretty soon, it looks not like a gentle rain in which we'll play it safe by heading in, but a surprise squall in which we're fighting for our safety. And in that squall, I look up at my dad's face, and it's not calm. He's worried. He's watching the dock, hoping but not sure that we'll make it back. Well, we do make it back. By the time lightning cracks across the sky, we're safely in the car, out of sight of the lake. And soon we're safely in our beds. It's a while before I go to sleep. Lying there awake, I realize that it's a different world than it had been this morning. For now, after a storm at sea, I realize a thing that we all learn, that there are troubles in the world that are bigger than my father's ability to keep me safe. The world was bigger than it had ever been, and my father, a tiny sailor like me. We've sailed a lot together since then, my father and I have. Sometimes he's helped me through the storm. Sometimes I've helped him. Both of us all the time, just a little bit more awestruck than we used to be by the journey. And that's where Bill's story took me. Where did it take you? And who will you take along?
I want to introduce you to another show from the BYU Radio family of podcasts. It's called The Lisa Show, and it's hosted by comedian, believer, actress, single mother, Lisa Valentine Clark. The Lisa Show delves into the multitude of challenges and relationships that shape our lives, whether it's parenting, mental health questions, social issues. She and her council of moms will tackle it. She'll help you figure out this thing called life. With a lot of laughs along the way, Lisa is a great person to hang around with. The Lisa Show. Listen wherever you get your podcasts. You can find it on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, all kinds of places to listen to The Lisa Show whenever you like. The Lisa Show from BYU Radio.
We're so glad to have you with us today on The Appleseed. Our next father and son story is told to us by Kevin Kling, the great Minnesota storyteller, who talks about a family trait, one apparently passed down from his father and grandfather and great-grandfather. What's the trait? Well, that may shock you. You'll see what I mean. Here's Kevin with a story he calls Lightning in Church.
Thank you all. All right, I want to tell some dad stories. My dad was a big influence on my life. And the first one I want to tell, my dad used to tell me, Kevin, you can go anywhere if you know where you're from. And I always loved that. And he'd say, you're going to spend the first half of your life running away from home and the second half trying to get back. And boy, is it ever the truth. Trying to find home after you've When you're a kid, man, you just want to run. I just wanted to go anywhere. I wanted to go to the stars. So I'm the age that he was when he passed away. So when I look in the mirror, I want to see him looking back at me. But I don't look like my dad, but I really wished I did. I take after my mom. Actually, I'm really glad. My mom's got really strong genes. So I feel really good that I take after my mom. But I think about my dad. Where did we connect? How did I connect with my dad when I don't look like him? And here's one of the ways I connect with my dad. I came across a story when I was in New York City. I was in New York for the first time telling stories. I was so excited to tell stories that night. And I was sitting at breakfast having my eggs and potatoes and toast and coffee. And the server was walking by. And I asked, oh, can I get some water? And she said, it's in the coffee. okay, this isn't Minnesota. And I thought, man, it's different here. How am I going to get everybody aboard? They've probably seen more on the subway this morning than has happened in my whole life. And so this is one of the stories I told him, and it was a dad story because those are good connectors. My dad and I were together the first time I was struck by lightning. I was laying in a puddle of water. I was 14 years old, and I was with my dad. We were underneath the fuselage of an airplane when my dad asked for a screwdriver. So I was handing it over to him when all of a sudden, bam, lightning struck the puddle, and I felt this lightning shoot through my body. I felt my organs hit together. I felt my stomach hit, my liver hit, my spleen. I think, man, I've been hit by lightning. I've been hit by lightning. And then I think the fact I know I've been hit, that means I'm still alive. So I say, Dad, Dad, we've been hit by lightning. And my dad says, that does it. Let's go home. He's a farm boy, you know. Can't stay out here all day. We'll just keep getting hit by lightning. So years later, my dad passed away, and I was at his funeral at a large round table like you see a lot of times if you've ever been to a funeral. And all my uncles were there, my brother, my grandpa. My dad's dad was still alive at the time. And I decided to tell that story because we weren't going to get new memories. So we were holding on to those old ones as tight as we could. And I decided to tell that story, and I just got into it. When my Uncle Donald, sitting across the table, goes, wait a second. He says, I've been struck by lightning. He says, I've been struck three times because you know what? Once you've been hit by lightning, your chances of getting hit again actually increase by over 50%. He said, it's actually more the symptom than the problem. My grandpa said he was hit four times. Grandpa said he was coming in from the field once. He's a farmer. He had his tool belt on. Grandpa said lightning struck, and he flew up in the air and formed a fountain with himself and his tools. My Uncle Byron was hit four times, and he has a metal plate in his head from the war. What war? He won't tell us. And he drives an Airstream trailer home, one of those metal trailer homes. We're like, Byron, you're begging for it, pal. But I found out then and there, all my uncles, my grandpa, my brother, my dad, and myself, we were all struck by lightning. So I told them that story, or the day, as they put it, I found out I was not adopted. Now, I've been telling that story for years. And just a couple years ago, my mom calls me on the phone, and she's really energetic. And she said, Kevin, you won't believe it. She goes, I was turning the TV. She has an old antenna on top of the house. She goes, I was turning the station when all of a sudden, bam, lightning hit the antenna. It shot through as I was turning the channel and blew me across the room. And she goes, so I came to the phone. She called me before the doctor to say, I knew it wasn't just on your father's side. So that's one of the connectors do I have with my dad. My fondest memories, though, is going to church. On Sunday mornings, I would wake up to the Tijuana Brass at 6 in the morning, blaring on the stereo. My dad's idea of reveille was Herb Alpert. And I would get up, and there was my brother's twin bed next to my twin bed with a huge char mark at the end of the bed from that day when I said, no, Steve, beds don't burn. A bed actually cannot burn. A bed is too complex. Paper burns and wood burns because they're simple. But a bed has too many components. So we wadded up three Sunday papers, shoved it under the bed, lit it. Oh, there went that theory. Don't do that. So we get up. It's Sunday morning. I go into the bathroom, and my dad's got hair gel in his hand, Brill Cream, and he rubs it into my head, and then he takes out his personal pocket-sized plastic comb, and he starts going through my hair. But he's digging. He's a farm boy, so he's plowing. Ow, ow, digging little red furrows in the tops of my head. And then he goes for that white that button on my white shirt with his stubby farm boy finger in between my neck and the collar, and he finally gets the button, and he pulls his hand away. And I breathe in, but I breathe in solid Brill Cream. And off I go, off into the ether, off into a place I'd try to get back to many times in the 70s. And I come back down, and my dad scoops me up, and he puts me in the car with my sister, Laura, and he honks the horn. Come on, Dora. Come on. We're late, Dora. And my mom comes out front with her apron still on to show she'd worked right up to the last minute, and she gets in the car, slams the door. Boom. We're in third gear by the end of the driveway. Now, I don't know whether it's because maybe we're barometers for the tension of the morning or we're in a confined space. Whatever it is, before I know it, my hand is wadded into a fist, and it's pounding my brother in the ear. Boom, boom, boom. And my sister screaming, the boys are fighting, the boys are fighting. I can't do anything. I don't know what she had to do, but apparently she can't do it while we're fighting. And Dad says, knock it off. That's warning number one. Warning number one, that means nothing. So we keep going, boom, boom, boom. He says, boys, I said knock that off. Uh-oh, that's warning number two. That means action, but it's too late. We're too far into it. He says, boys. Knock that off. That's warning number three. That means action. So we stop. No, Dad, look, see, we're pals. Too late. all of a sudden, my dad's got out what we called the claw, and the claw came back into the back seat in search of human flesh, of our human flesh. So we're dodging our human flesh, trying to keep it out of the way of the claw. And if the claw hits your leg, you scream like you're in pain, even though you're not. Ah, hoping the claw will show some mercy. Oh, it never did. And so all of a sudden you realize, okay, the claw's not going to stop till it gets human flesh. Now that's either my human flesh or my brother's human flesh. So I grab some of his human flesh and try to jam it into the claw, and he's trying to do the same thing to me. And pretty soon it clamps down on his leg, and he's screaming. And if you aren't getting the claw, your proper reaction is to watch politely. The claw stops squeezing and it retracts. And I look over at my brother. He's sitting there, calm and peaceful, like, it's 9 a.m, and I already survived the claw. How bad can this day be? We pull into the church parking lot. We go and we sit in the back pew. We've already missed the announcements, but we hear an anthem, and then we sing a hymn. Holy, holy, holy. Everyone except my dad. Holy, holy, holy. God gave Dad one note, and that's the note he brought to church. And mercifully, the song ends, and we all take our seat. And then the pastor, the Lutheran pastor, comes toward the microphone, and everyone drops about 2 inches, because this is going to take a while, and it's going to be on his one note. And my dad, you could see his baby blue eyes roll up in his head, and his head go to one direction. And Dad always snored at home in bed. But in church, he had a silencer. He'd go to sleep completely quiet, and when I'd see his sleeve roll back, my brother and I said, oh, we can have our breath-holding competitions. Go to sleep, go to sleep. And this was going to be the best week, because we just saw this movie called Houdini, starring Tony Curtis. And in this movie, Houdini held his breath for 3 minutes. Oh, we could do that. We've been practicing our whole lives. Okay, go to sleep, go to sleep. Dad goes to sleep. There's that watch. We warm up our lungs. 1 minute, no problem. 2 minutes, a little bit more of a problem, but still okay. At 2.5 minutes, I hear my brother go, he's going to lose it. He's going to lose it. Sure enough, he lets the air out through his mouth. Always let the air out through your mouth. Never through your nose. If you let your air out through your nose, people hear it and say, who's having breath-only competitions? So let the air out through your mouth. And he lets it out. And now it's up to me. 255, 256, 257. Praise God from whom all blessings flow. It's a doxology. So everyone stands up. So I stand up. I haven't breathed in 3 minutes. And the church takes one big spin over my head, and I am out cold. And in my delirium, I can hear the congregation. He's had a vision. He's seen Jesus. Except Dr. Richardson, not in my church. Nobody sees Jesus in my church. And my dad finally scoops me up, runs me into the bathroom, and says, holding your breath again, huh? How did he know? How did my dad always know? I mean, my brother could look at a rock in the driveway and my dad would say, don't even think about it. Or he'd thump me in the back of the head and say, that's for what I didn't see. It's like, so we'd get in the car and we would ride home. And I remember in the night, we would drive through the nighttime looking out of the back of that station wagon, and the world looked like a black and white photograph. And all of a sudden, all the lights in the farmhouses started going out. And my dad goes, 10 o'clock. I thought he was like the amazing Kreskin, that he could call all those lights going out, when in fact he knew Walter Cronkite had just finished the news and all those farmers would be off to bed. And we would ride home with the black and white world framed behind us, all the lights going out, and my dad was magic. Thank you.
That was Kevin Kling with Lightning in Church. Do you have memories of your dad or your grandfather or your mom that have become important to you? Have you inherited any traits from generations before you that have surprised you? What moments have stuck with you the longest or keep coming back to teach you things as you need them? I bet you've got some stories. We hope you'll share them with the people you love. In fact, we hope you'll share the stories with us. We might share them on the show. You can tag us on social media or send us a message at theappleseed@byu.edu. That's theappleseed, all one word, at byu.edu. And the Appleseed isn't just an audio podcast. We also have a YouTube channel where you can watch our storytellers bring their story to life in front of live studio audiences. Just go to youtube.com and search for the Appleseed for videos and shorts to watch and share with the people you love. And don't forget to subscribe while you're there. You may be there now. We want to thank Bill Lepp and Kevin Kling for sharing their stories with us today. You've listened to their stories. Now it's time to share some of your own. The Appleseed is produced by me, Sam Payne, Wendy Folsom, and Brian Tanner. Assistant producers include Garrett Gunnell, Carrie Griggs, Kay Hendrickson, and Nico Wetzel. And our post team is Trent Reimschussel and DJ Cromartie. We're pleased and proud to be among the many podcasts produced by the BYU Radio family of shows. If you want more great storytelling for the whole family, then search for our companion podcasts, Kaboom for original audio adventures, and Wink, Stories for Better Bedtimes. All our podcasts can be found on YouTube, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or on the BYU Radio app or at byuradio.org. Don't forget to subscribe, rate us, leave us a review. That's how the shows grow. I'm Sam Payne, and we can't wait to be with you again on the Appleseed.